All right, welcome to the Literary Hangover. I'm your host, Matt Leck. With me again is Alex Guns.
Hello.
And joining me for the first time is Grace. Grace, hi. How would you like to identify yourself, Grace?
Just Grace is fine.
Just
by
Grace,
me.
Okay. And Grace is new. She's Alex's friend. I've met her. So if this goes,
end of this episode, she could be Matt's friend too. We'll see.
It could be. And if this goes poorly, this is reflects on Alex. But Grace, you have a background in literary studies. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I come from the southwest of England, but I've lived in New York for about 5 years now. For my undergraduate degree, I studied literature at Cambridge University, which gives me a fairly decent grounding in the kind of great white male canon school of literature.
That's important here.
Yeah. But fascinatingly, though, I took the American paper, which is the kind of one way that a Cambridge student is able to access American literature, I never encountered Sedgwick. I never encountered Hope Leslie in that course, although we read Emerson and Melville and Whitman. No sign of Hope Leslie there.
Yeah, and I will concur. I think we might have mentioned this before, but I also, in any of my American literature seminars or classes, if she came up, it was only in a passing reference, basically.
Yeah, it's only the name. Definitely, I did feel like before you brought up Hope Leslie, I can't imagine I've ever heard that book title before.
So that brings me to the first academic. I need a jingle for academic research references to spice it up a little bit.
Like a ruler hitting something like whoosh, academic paper.
This is from Revisioning America's Literary Past, Sedgwick's Hope Leslie by Patricia Larson Kalagian from the NWSA Journal in autumn 1996. There's a few sections I wanted to read here, but we're talking about why she's been forgotten, and Kalagian has some thoughts on that. Quote, her strategic opposition to both the dehumanization and destruction of Native Americans and to the construction of women as models of submissiveness may serve to explain why Hope Leslie was, for so long, denied and denigrated. Today, there is general critical agreement that Sedgwick had significant influence on the writers who followed her, especially in terms of the female plot and the didactic novel. But we see less recognition of Sedgwick as part of the literary mainstream, as an early influential social critic, a formal and stylistic innovator, or an inverter of accepted race and gender stereotypes. In her six novels, dozens of short stories, and several didactic works, Sedgwick used her fictions to question the virtue of American life in the early national period. In addition to the origins of race misunderstanding in colonial times, she also examined religious hypocrisy, regional difference, slavery, capitalism, and a growing national acquisitiveness, prisons, and throughout her work, the social imperatives that made marriage a necessity to a meaningful female existence. Most, if not all, of these issues she explored before any other American novelist of note turned his or her hand to the tale. By introducing such important topics into the literary conversation, Sedgwick prepared the way for Hawthorne's criticism of Puritanism and religious hypocrisy, for Harriet Beecher Stowe's assault on slavery, and for the critiques of racial and cultural insensitivity written by Herman Melville. Her unique approach to nature may predict that of the transcendentalists. Because of Sedgwick's now marginalized position, we tend to discount the influences she had in her contemporary world. The literary frontier of the 1820s existed as a temporal and temporary site of opportunity for women writers, because the development of an American literature demanded the efforts of men and women alike. And just to go a bit more further into a footnote there, Kalagian notes, Harriet Martineau, for example, named Sedgwick the most popular writer in the United States. Edgar Allan Poe said of Sedgwick that, quote, few persons of sound and accurate discrimination would hesitate in placing her upon a level with the best of our native novelists. Of American female writers, we must consider her the first. And if people are familiar with Edgar Allan Poe's critical writings, he was very unkind, basically a shit poster would be the the name we would use today. Just constant. I'm reading a Poe biography now, and there's like a few different times where people are like, did you really have to phrase it that meanly, basically.
Yeah, did you really have to call Thoreau a cuck so many times?
Yeah, but he does like Sedgwick, or did like Sedgwick. He's not still alive, to my knowledge. But yeah, I guess what did you guys have any more thoughts on Sedgwick's sort of disappearing legacy and why that might be? And
yeah, it's always interesting when you read a book and you're like, this is quite the amazing book, and you can't find a lot of ancillary information about it or the author. And it makes it even more bizarre when you find out that this was actually a very successful book.
Right.
Like Hope Leslie. And by bizarre, I mean that it becomes like a sort of like crime scene. Like, well, what's happened for this book to have to be removed from our canon, basically?
Right. It's sort of like, to go back to the crime scene thing, like normally you just want to say, oh, it's just an accident. Meaning, I guess in this case would be that, oh, the public wasn't ready to read a female novelist or something at that point. But really it's more insidious to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, reading this book and then reading some of the academic articles that you guys provided, it's pretty obvious that what Sedgwick was trying to do, or at least what she did, whether she was fully conscious of it in the writing of the book, is a lot more radical than perhaps critics in the immediate period after her death were willing to kind of give her credit for, especially when you consider how much skepticism her work, and particularly this book, brings to bear on the whole kind of founding myth of America and Manifest Destiny in particular. I thought that came through really strongly by the end of the book.
Yeah, I couldn't help read her in the context of Jacksonian America.
Mm-hmm.
Like at a time of like absolutely flattening difference between cultures in America and the more Puritan white supremacy angle getting much more orderly and much more destructive in its intent to cleanse the nation. And meanwhile, there's this person writing a novel talking about a world that is filled with difference and conflict, and they don't necessarily mesh together very well, but there is like some sort of like concord within this messy early state.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of I guess a confirmation bias victory for people like us that are reading literature with these sensitivities, that that she addresses like race, she addresses gender, she addresses like like slavery
and intersectionality,
labor, intersectionality with the help and stuff. This going back to Kalajdzian, she writes in Revisioning America's Literary Past, is Hope Leslie a revisionist historical romance, the quote Dances and Wolves of the 1820s? Basically, because Dances and Wolves, I don't know if I've seen it, but like
Once you get done with Last of Mohicans, you should probably watch that one. It's like the right around the same time. It's that costume drama.
It basically just romanticizes and sterilizes history a little bit. Is that
the? Oh, yeah.
Perhaps so, but in a cultural climate that was considerably less repentant than the 1990s and only about to begin the real remorseless eradication of America's indigenous people. If it surprises us that a novel like Hope Leslie was never canonized, what should surprise us more is that it ever gained the kind of popularity and prestige it did enjoy. Its publication date of 1827 puts it into a marketplace that just months later would elect Andrew Jackson, the first president since George Washington to have combat experience against the Indians, and the first to endorse the forcible removal of Native Americans to reservations. The mood of the country was changing, the leadership was of a new breed, and the conciliatory nature of Sedgwick's historical romance would position it philosophically at the edges of liberal humanitarianism in a new era of ethnocentric, capital-driven expansionism. It should surprise us very little to see such a novel disappear into the ghetto of sentimentalism and domestic fiction. Its oppositional ideology trivialized, and its inventive dialogic subversion of authority labeled as confusing and confused.
The ghetto of sentimentalism.
That's where all women novels go.
Oh, for sure.
And then you actually read some of the male novels of that period, and it's like, this seems pretty fucking sentimental.
You mean the one where it's like George Washington was in a disguise, but he was too brave?
Yes, exactly.
You knew you could see him from a mile away.
And just trust me, spy. Yeah, exactly.
Something that I was wondering about as I was reading this essay was how this kind of a novel might have been received in England at the time, which was kind of in the throes of romanticism. When I first read Hope Leslie, I couldn't help but think about Percy Shelley and Wordsworth and the Romantic poets that I'm actually personally more familiar with, especially in the way that she figures the landscape, this very kind of sentimental connection to the land and a sense of heightened emotion at certain moments in the novel. And I wondered if perhaps her fate might have been different had she been writing across the pond.
Yeah, well, especially to go back to The Spy, we know that Fenimore Cooper was showing a lot of sensitivity to the British sense of superiority because they had abolished the slave trade. If Fenimore Cooper was sensitive to it, I mean, Sedgwick references both Fenimore Cooper and Walter Scott in different parts of this. Like, she would have been familiar, obviously, with that conversation as well.
Yeah, and I think to jump off of Grace's point, I think this is the first book that we've read and the first American book I can come across that's like in a deep dialogue with the English tradition of literature. Like, not only are the chapters opening with quotations largely from English writers, but she's weaving in and out like Elizabethan mannerisms and language, like not just Shakespeare, but going into like Ben Jonson and things like that. This is someone who is not just like well-read, but also is firmly placing herself like alongside these other writers.
Yeah, and I think we'll maybe get more into her deeper background in the next episode, but a quick summary is she comes from a old sort of school Federalist background with some ties. I mean, I don't even really want to get into it yet, but she has ancestors who married into Native American families. I don't want to get into that. it's too big of a can of worms.
I read that piece about her.
Yeah,
crazy relatives.
Basically, one of her ancestors was part of a massacre and was abducted and stayed in with the Native Americans. I think the Mohawks or some Native American tribe, and that was apparently the common thing: is if somebody transitioned from colonist to Native American, they're much more likely to stay Native American than those who transitioned from Indian life to colonial life.
But that was like repressed in the histories. People didn't want to talk about those instances.
Yeah, which is amazing. That's bad for a lot of literature in general. Like Daniel Boone myths is basically trying to convince people to come to Kentucky to settle, right? Like there's a real estate motive behind a lot of this. And similar to like that, right? Like you're trying to get people to come over. You don't want them to find out that like there's a chance like your daughter goes and stays with the Native Americans for good.
Yeah.
And then she also had some other relatives, but again, I'm just gonna gloss over that. Here's what this is: Michael Davitt Bell in History and Romance Convention in Catherine Maria Sedgwick's Hopeless, and I believe this is like a 1970s article. He writes of Sedgwick this. At the age of 20, she joined a Calvinist church in New York, but increasingly offended by what seemed to her the uncharitable hypocrisy of Calvinism, she went over to Unitarianism in 1821, thus in her own life following the supposed progress from artificial dogma to natural and reasonable faith. The immediate effect of this step was her first novel, A New England Tale, in 1822, begun as an attack on Puritan hypocrisy. The book was an instant success. Redwood, a novel of New England manners, followed in 1824. Praising it in the North American Review in 1825, Miss Sedgwick's close friend, William Cullen Bryant, nonetheless regretted that the author had, quote, not gone back to the infancy of the country, and went on to list the aspects of American history which ought to engage the American novelist. Inspired apparently by her friend's advice, Catherine Sedgwick turned to the study of New England history in preparation for her next novel. When the product of this research appeared in 1827 as Hope Leslie or Early Times in the Massachusetts, it was an immediate success, one of the more popular American books both at home and abroad before 1850.
So we've run into this trope a couple of times now on this show of a writer getting massive success in the early 19th century by writing a story about colonial and specifically 17th century American history. Do you have a theory for why that is, or why that's so popular in the 1820s and 30s to up to the 50s, I guess?
I mean, my first guess would be it's the sort of nascent nationalism, and they've never... Richard Slotkin, who's one of my favorite authors, he writes about the mythology of America, basically. He says that you know, previous national mythologizing had taken place in a much more technologically antiquated media environment, like especially older ones, German fairy or folk tales, for instance, right? Like that, a lot of that is was originally like spoken and vocal lore, right? And then it just gets copied down by the Grimms or whatever. In America, it was much more self-conscious and much more, I guess, synthetic. Like people decided, or people recognized that we lacked these sorts of national myths, and then they decided we need to fill that gap, I think. Okay, so I think we can sort of get to the actual story now. In this edition, we're going to be covering the preface and the first three chapters. I'm going to go back to Michael Devitt Bell for a summary of this, because to summarize this book is not an easy task. So I'm going to steal this from a JSTOR. Miss Sedgwick launches the incredibly complicated plot of Hope Leslie. And I should just note, later academics will take issue with some of the maybe condescending language that he uses here, like the incredibly complicated plot. It's fairly complicated, right? But I don't know if you need to have the adjective there.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
Come on. Miss Sedgwick launches the incredibly complicated plot of Hope Leslie by sketching in the background of a Puritan named William Fletcher. We are told that Fletcher was in love with his cousin, Alice, but was kept from marrying her by her father, an Episcopalian, on account of Fletcher's religion. She was forced instead to marry a Charles Leslie, to whom she bore two daughters, Hope and Faith. Fletcher also married, and in 1630 joined his friend Winthrop in emigrating to New England. In 1636, he and his family moved to the outskirts of Springfield on the western frontier of Massachusetts. As the romance opens, Fletcher has just returned to Boston to receive, as their guardian, the two orphaned girls of Alice Leslie, who have come to New England with their aunt, Mrs. Grafton. Mrs. Fletcher sends Faith back to Springfield, keeping Hope with him while he finishes some business in Boston. Now, we're going to go right to where the preface, which is an interesting preface, where Sedgwick sort of editorializes. And I actually think it's one of the more interesting prefaces I've read for this project. I'd say the only one that would compete would be Hawthorne's in The House of the Seven Gables. But here is the first part where Sedgwick is writing about sort of the racial messages of her story here.
Those who have not paid much attention to the history or character of these early settlements, if they choose to turn their attention to this interesting subject, will be surprised to find how clear, copious, and authentic are the accounts which our ancestors left behind them. The only merit claimed by the present writer is that of a patient investigation of all the materials that could be obtained. A full delineation of these times was not even attempted, but the main solicitude has been to exclude everything decidedly inconsistent with them. The Indians of North America are, perhaps, the only race of men of whom it may be said that though conquered, they were never enslaved. They could not submit and live. When made captives, they courted death and exulted in torture. These traits of their character will be viewed by an impartial observer in a light very different from that in which they were regarded by our ancestors. In our histories, it was perhaps natural that they should be represented as, quote, surly dogs, end quote, who preferred to die rather than live, from no other motives than a stupid or malignant obstinacy. Their own historians or poets, if they had such, would as naturally and with more justice have extolled their high-souled courage and patriotism. The writer is aware that it may be thought that the character of Magawiska has no prototype among the aborigines of this country. Without citing Pocahontas, or any other individual, as authority, it may be sufficient to remark that in such delineations we are confined not to the actual, but to the possible. The liberal philanthropist will not be offended by a representation which supposes that the elements of virtue and intellect are not withheld from any branch of the human family, and the enlightened and accurate observer of human nature will admit that the differences of character among the various races of the earth arises mainly from the difference of condition.
You have any comment on that, or I can go to?
I mean, it's wild. ahead of its time is such a cliche, but she basically just said like it's material condition that decides like your place in the world, which is like proto-Marx.
Yeah, exactly. And we would have and I'll quibble with a few things afterwards, but it would have been nice if this was the message that carried the 19th century and not scientific racism.
Yeah.
Right? Like this is like when, especially when she's writing, is when the full like sort of tools of the Enlightenment, if not the spirit, but the tools are being used to justify racialized slavery more formally even.
Oh yeah.
And I think the time period she chose was sort of the start of that. Like, that's where I would recognize, especially when you talk about slavery that we recognize here as, and you know, as distinct from, you know, ancient forms of bondage.
Well, I think, yeah, in this moment in particular, she kind of predates, she's right before it, but I feel like this is the moment in American history that what she's publishing in, that like that they're giving up on the project, or they finally have the ability to wipe out Native American influence on the American body politic. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, we're doing it. Like, that's it. Like, this idea that we can live with them or we have to live with them is absurd. And we have the power and the tools now and the will to just kill them all or to force them off, like, out of our line of sight, which they did.
Yeah. And, you know, the idea that they were never enslaved, although they could be conquered, they're never enslaved, is that's where I have the quibbles, because I think that's sort of racially essentializing, right? Like these proud people, that's the reason people get enslaved is not because they're of their character, right, and how good they are about fighting it. Mm-hmm. Like it's about material conditions and things and power and things like that. Sedgwick gets a pass for that, I think, because she literally reproduces and represents that happening in America in the story. Like Magawisca is a product of slavery. Or not a product of slavery. She's a she's enslaved, and I sort of got to this in the Mystic the Mystic Massacre episode. Now let's go a little bit forward to where William Fletcher is being warned away from marrying Alice, his cousin, and not because they're cousins, but because of William Fletcher's propensity to liberty. He's a liberty lover, and this guy's a Church of England guy.
Yeah, he sure is a liberty lover. The liberty to marry his cousin.
Yeah, that's taking liberty a bit too far there, buddy. But that's a common thing. I'm also reading The Winthrop Woman by Anya Seton, and that also includes kissing cousins.
They're abound in this book.
Yeah.
Like possible brother-sister relations that are like, we should also maybe hook up.
Yeah, you hook up also, you know, you're colonizing, so you need to procreate. Like,
true.
You can do that with a cousin, turns out.
Especially in England today, that still happens.
Oh, yeah?
Really?
Yeah.
Is that not just a monarchy thing?
Within kind of royal bloodlines, it's still kind of a thing.
No, yeah. Matt was so excited for a minute. Like, wait, are you serious? And then, yeah.
It's not like Russell Brand's not marrying his cousin. Yeah. Yeah, so let's go to this where this is actually going to be from a letter, and here's a vocabulary word for you listeners. Epistolary. Ooh. Oh, I've never heard that.
Wow, read and write.
very common in early novels as a medium. It's sort of like how telephone calls are popular in podcasts. Like it's just a medium that's. I don't know if that metaphor really works, but like an older format gets transferred onto a newer format just because that's easier than what people are used to.
I think
maybe it's a stretch.
Nah, I kind of get what you're saying.
But right, people were used to getting letters, and they're like, "What if these letters were fake? We just could fake these letters and write a whole story that way."
That's the first epistolary novel.
I think the ultimate epistolary novel is Frankenstein. Which was published not too long before or after this one.
Yeah, 24, 25, right?
In 1824. The 20s. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's entirely composed of letters.
When's Clarissa?
Ooh. In the 18th century, I think.
Have you read Evelina by Fanny Burney?
Nope.
That's, she was an influence on Jane Austen. And that is entirely epistolary as well, and I actually really like it. It's a great book. But So yeah, let's go to this. This is this a part of this letter here, and it sort of gets to the what I think is interesting that that Sedgwick does is she shows how the men in this book are chasing their own form of liberty, and often that has to do with both for men and women. Liberty basically means who you end up sleeping with. There's a lot of warning people against marrying certain people, and trying to arrange marriages. Here is what leaves William Fletcher to leave England.
There are those that are forever inquiring and inquiring, and never coming to truth. One inquiry should suffice for a loyal subject, what is established. And that being well ascertained, the line of duty is so plain that he who runs may read. I would that all our youths had inscribed on their hearts that golden rule of political religion, framed and well maintained by our good Queen Elizabeth. No man should be suffered to decline either on the left or on the right hand, from the drawn line limited by authority, and by the sovereign's laws and injunctions. Instead of such healthy maxims, our lads' heads are crammed with the philosophy and rhetoric and history of those liberty-loving Greeks and Romans. This is the pernicious lore that has poisoned our academical fountains. Liberty, what is it? Daughter of disloyalty and mother of all misrule, who, from the hour that she tempted our first parents to forfeit paradise, hath ever worked mischief to our race. But above all, brother, as you value the temporal salvation of your boy, restrain him from all confederacy, association, or even acquaintance with the Puritans. If my master took counsel of me, he would ship these mad canting fools to our New England colonies, where their tender consciences would be no more offended because, forsooth, a prelate saith his prayers in white vestments, and where they might enjoy with the savages that primitive equality, about which they make such a pother. God forfend that our good lad William should company with these misdoers. He must be narrowly watched, for, as I hear, there is a neighbor of yours, one Winthrop, a notable gentleman, as they say, but he doth grievously scandalize his birth and breeding, who hath embraced these scurvy principles, and doth magnify them with the authority of his birth and condition, and hath much weight with the country. There is in Suffolk, too, as I am told, one Elliot, a young zealot, a fanatical incendiary, who doth find ample combustibles in the gossiping matrons, idle maidens, and lawless youth who flock about him. These are dangerous neighbors. Rouse yourself, brother. Give over your idle sporting with hawk and hound, and watch over this goodly scion of ours. Ours, I say, but I forewarn you, no daughter or guinea of mine shall ever go to one who is infected with this spreading plague.
Goes on to say that that was not convincing to William Fletcher or his father. And ultimately, as we heard from the summary, he ended up marrying somebody else, and his cousin ended up marrying elsewhere, and he moved with Winthrop to Massachusetts.
But it's kind of vague as to, like, did he really leave for liberty and all of that, or did he leave to get away from the woman he couldn't get? Or at least that was my reading.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That the conviction in, like, his own personal life is, like, convictions and his personal life conflate in a way.
It's almost like there's a belief that just the liberty loving would not be enough to send him to the United States, right? Like,
yeah.
That it must also be set off by some personal drama that explains it, basically.
Well, especially in that excerpt where it, like, lambasts, like, philosophical theory to begin with, that it's like this isn't enough to, that, like, it poisons people's minds anyways.
Liberty does.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also very interesting to hear the monarchical authoritarianism articulated like that. Like, nobody should be able to decline on the left or right hand more than is stated by authorities.
Yeah.
Like, you just can't get away with saying that anymore. People are just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Your basis for rule is, you know, insemination. Like,
yeah. Well, now we have... Now we have, like, our president giving press conferences being like, I could say that, I won't, because I could be wrong, I don't know, which is, like, obviously far better than monarchy.
So let's move to a section that I saw Alex post about, this about home can never be repeated.
Oh, yeah.
We'll play this part here.
Mr. Fletcher was at first welcomed as an important acquisition to the infant establishment, but he soon proved that he purposed to take no part in its concerns, and in spite of the remonstrances of the proprietors, he fixed his residence a mile from the village, deeming exposure to the incursions of the savages very slight, and the surveillance of an inquiring neighborhood a certain evil. His domain extended from a gentle eminence, and commanded an extensive view of the bountiful Connecticut to the shore, where the river indented the meadow by one of those sweeping graceful curves by which it seems to delight to beautify the land it nourishes. The border of the river was fringed with all the water-loving trees, but the broad meadows were quite cleared, excepting that a few elms and sycamores had been spared by the Indians and consecrated by tradition as the scene of revels or councils. The house of our pilgrims was a low-roofed, modest structure, containing ample accommodation for a patriarchal family, where children, dependents, and servants were all to be sheltered under one roof tree. On one side, as we have described, lay an open and extensive plain. Within view was the curling smoke from the little cluster of houses about the fort, the habitation of civilized man, but all else was a savage, howling wilderness. Never was a name more befitting the condition of a people than Pilgrim, that of our forefathers. It should be redeemed from the puritanical and ludicrous associations which have degraded it in most men's minds, and be hallowed by the sacrifices made by these voluntary exiles. They were pilgrims, for they had resigned forever what the good hold most dear, their homes. Homes can never be transferred, never repeated in the experience of an individual. The place consecrated by parental love, by the innocence and sports of childhood, by the first acquaintance with nature, by the linking of the heart to the visible creation, is the only home. There is a living and breathing spirit infused into nature. Every familiar object has a history, the trees have tongues, and the very air is vocal. There the vesture of decay doth not close in and control the noble functions of the soul. It sees and hears and enjoys without the ministry of gross material substance.
Now, I think that section might be a bit too easy on the Puritans, but I think there's sort of a, explicitly anyway, but I think there's sort of a, I think there's some sort of reading between the lines that can be done there, right? Like, the Puritans aren't the only ones losing their homes in this instance, especially when you talk about the Pequots, who feature heavily in it. Do you is that the irony you guys read there as well?
I'm not sure that I read so much irony into it as much as an attempt to kind of reframe the Puritans and kind of strip them of what she calls their ludicrous associations, and bringing back a sense of just how kind of bold and radical their decision was to leave. But I think you're right that there is real irony in the word resigned, the fact that they had actively chosen to leave their homes as opposed to had their homes stolen from them,
right,
or destroyed. And I think the fact that she, you know, this passage to me reads as like ridiculously prelapsarian as a scene, and it's contrasted pretty violently later when we see scenes of massacre and destruction upon that same land.
I also like earlier in the clip where they're talking about Fletcher, who's like decides to live outside of town because already you can tell the people are going to be annoying to him. Like, yeah. You've literally just moved across an ocean.
Yeah. Or, like, well, he did spend the entire time on like an entire boat ride with them. So yeah, maybe he's like, I can't be dealing with this.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move a bit forward to when this is chapter 2 now, where actually that was chapter 2 as well. this is where Fletcher gets a letter informing him that Alice, his cousin that he was in love with, has died, and the two daughters are going to be coming to stay here, to stay with him.
That which I have to tell you, and it were best that it were told quickly, is that my cousin Alice was a passenger in this newly arrived ship. Martha, your blushes wrong you. The mean jealousies that degrade some women have, I am sure, never been harbored in your heart. If I deserve your praise, it is because the Lord has been pleased to purify my heart and make it his sanctuary. But if I have not the jealousies, I have the feelings of a woman. And I cannot forget that you was once affianced to your cousin Alice, and that I told you once, Martha, frankly, that the affection I gave her could not be transferred to another. That love grew with my growth, strengthened with my strength. Of its beginning, I had no more consciousness than of the commencement of my existence. It was sunshine and flowers in all the paths of my childhood. It inspired every hope, modified every project. Such was the love I bore to Alice, love immortal as the soul. You know how cruelly we were severed at Southampton, how she was torn from the strand by the king's guards, within my view, almost within my grasp. How Sir William tempted me with the offer of pardon, my cousin's hand, and, poor temptation indeed after that, honors, fortune. You know that even Alice, my precious, beautiful Alice, knelt to me, that smitten of God and man, and for the moment bereft of the right use of reason, she would have persuaded me to yield my integrity. You know that her cruel father reproached me with virtually breaking my plighted troth, that many of my friends urged my present conformity, and you know, Martha, that there was a principle in my bosom that triumphed over all these temptations. And think you not that principle has preserved me faithful in my friendship to you? Think you not that your obedience, your careful conformity to my wishes, your steady love, which hath kept far more than even measure with my deserts, is undervalued, can be lightly estimated? Oh, I know, said the humble wife, that your goodness to me does far surpass my merit. But bethink you, it is the nature of a woman to crave the first place. It is the right of a wife, Martha, and there is none now to contest it with you. This is but the second time I have spoken to you on a subject that has been much in our thoughts, that has made me wayward, and would have made my sojourning on earth miserable, but that you have been my support and comforter. These letters contain tidings that have opened a long-sealed fountain. My uncle, Sir William, died in January. Leslie perished in a foreign service. Alice, thus released from all bonds, and sole mistress of her fortunes, determined to cast her lot in the heritage of God's people. She embarked with her two girls, her only children. A tempestuous voyage proved too much for a constitution already broken by repeated shocks. She was fully aware of her approaching death, and died as befits a child of faith, in sweet peace. Would to God I could have seen her once more, but, he added, raising his eyes devoutly, not my will but thine be done. The sister of Leslie, a mistress Grafton, attended Alice, and with her she left a will committing her children to my guardianship. It will be necessary for me to go to Boston to assume this trust. I shall leave home tomorrow, after making suitable provision for your safety and comfort in my absence.
So I just have a question. Maybe you two picked up on it, and I may have missed it. So in this letter, he finds out that his first great love has died. Did he also find out in that letter that she had come to the New World, that she was essentially his neighbor? Or did he know that before?
I don't think he knew before the letter that she was coming over. I think that starts at the beginning of the letter, that he finds out that she was a passenger on the ship. Which actually is interesting, because what is she just going to come over there with kids? And
Well, it's something kind of heartbreaking about it, that they, because he decided to leave town, that he would have never known, except for her dying, that she would have been like so close, basically.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's something I just picked up on while I was reading it.
What did you feel about Martha, his wife, we talked about how it's unclear how much of, you know, his heartbreak led him to leave England. She sort of has a sort of mirror heartbreak where she's not the first choice for her husband and she's aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, come on, woman, know your duty. Like, you're my wife. What are you complaining about, sort of thing? And that, I think that is something, I think the tone deafness of him is when I want to read Sedgwick as being more subversive, it's like, these are the patriarchs and they're not terribly, their authority, especially in retrospect, looks questionable.
Yeah, it's part of the human condition to like to get hurt and then in turn like to hurt someone else.
Yeah,
usually for like even like the same things, being like having zero empathy for someone who just went through what you went through and be like, well, you know, it's not,
yeah,
not my problem.
You're a wife. What do you want me to do?
Yeah, you're literally my property. So,
and I think for her, it's almost like a point of pride that she kind of brooks all of his emotional mess in the scene, and she kind of filters it all through the lens of piety and what it means to be a good wife mm-hmm. to him. And so I think ultimately it's like a way for her to show her virtue.
Right. And it's just sad because like that's the only avenue that's really open to her is
fealty.
Yeah, like show me how subservient you are.
Yeah, I think that's one of the benefits of the patriarchy is that no one is hurt as much as the patriarch. Like no one can possibly go through as much pain as this person who has every material need he would ever want.
Right. All right. So here we go to where the new children that he's going to have to look after, the daughters of his cousin slash ex-flame, are going
to
require...
The children that she's going to have to look after.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to have to look after some kids, and that's going to require some more domestic labor. Mm-hmm. And so here is where we touch on that.
These children will bring additional labor to your household, and in good time hath our thoughtful friend Governor Winthrop procured for us 2 Indian servants. The girl has arrived. The boy is retained about the little Leslies, the youngest of whom, it seems, is a petted child and is particularly pleased by his activity in ministering to her amusements. I am glad if any use can be made of an Indian servant, said Mrs. Fletcher, who, oppressed with conflicting emotions, expressed the lightest of them, a concern at a sudden increase of domestic cares where there were no facilities to lighten them. How any use? You surely do not doubt, Martha, that these Indians possess the same faculties that we do. The girl just arrived, our friend writes me, hath rare gifts of mind, such as few of God's creatures are endowed with. She is just 15. She understands and speaks English perfectly well, having been taught it by an English captive who for a long time dwelt with her tribe. On that account, she was much noticed by the English who traded with the Pequods, and young as she was, she acted as their interpreter. She is the daughter of one of their chiefs, and when this wolfish tribe were killed or dislodged from their dens, she, her brother, and their mother were brought with a few other captives to Boston. They were given for a spoil to the soldiers. Some, by a Christian use of the money, were redeemed, and others, I blush to say it, for it is God's gift that every man should enjoy the good of his own labor, were sent into slavery in the West Indies. Minoka, the mother of these children, was noted for the singular dignity and modesty of her demeanor. Many notable instances of her kindness to the white traders are recorded, and when she was taken to Boston, our worthy governor, ever mindful of his duties, assured her that her good deeds were held in remembrance, and that he would testify the gratitude of his people in any way that she should direct. I have nothing to ask, she said, but that I and my children may receive no personal dishonor.
That is a historically accurate... that's something that happened in Winthrop specifically. I want to go to this article. So this is from Possession, Indian Bodies, Cultural Control, and Colonialism in the Pequot War by Andrea Robertson Kramer, Early American Studies, Fall 2008. She says, the forced servitude of Pequot women and children and the sale of Pequot men into slavery represent forms of violence that catalyzed an emerging social hierarchy based on race. In addition, the capture and enslavement of Pequots served to reverse the emasculation of English captives at the war's outset. The gendered colonial conquest furthered economic expansion of Anglo-American settlements. Not only was this process linked to the subjugation of Indians, but it played a pivotal role in the facilitation of racially based slavery, beginning with the importation of African slaves in exchange for Pequot men in the mid-17th century. The eagerness with which the English embarked on their new enterprise of capture and enslavement of Pequots was summarized by Reverend Hugh Peter. Quote, "We have heard of a dividence of women and children in the bay and would be glad to share viz period. What does that, how do you translate that when you read it? And would be glad of a share viz, I need to look that up.
Is that grace?
Like, is that like vis-a-vis?
Yeah. I thought it was visage.
I did not take Latin.
Namely. We have heard of a dividence of women and children in the bay and would be glad of a share, namely, a young woman or girl or boy, if you think good. I wrote to you for some boys for Bermudas, which I think is considerable." She continues, "The process by which Pequot captives were identified and distributed evoked additional scrutiny of sex roles through the surveillance and control of Pequot bodies. News of the appropriation of Pequots into English service spread rapidly even in the early part of the Pequot War. Women and children, viewed as the least threatening, were bound in service in English homes or were distributed among Narragansett and Mohegan communities. One scholarly interpretation of this practice argued that Pequot women and children were incorporated into English homes to relieve a gender imbalance among those house servants in 17th century New England. Though it is not inconceivable that the English suffered a dearth of female help in their households, the more complex motivations for capture of Pequot women and children appear in an analysis of the discussion of captive women's bodies in 17th century documents. The forcible introduction of Pequot women into English households furthered not only the subjugation of Pequot communities under governance of the social covenant, but also undercut Pequot male rule. Requests poured into the Bay Colony's governor as Anglo-American men sought Pequot servants. One such request, this is the page I was looking for, one such request sent to John Winthrop came from Israel Stoughton in June 1637. "Honored sir, by this penance being giggles," now that's a weird form of language, "by this penance being giggles." A pinnace, P-I-N-N-A-C-E, is a type of boat.
Ah.
I don't know why being giggles, I think that means the guy who was the trader who owned the boat.
So annoying.
"Honored sir, by this pinnace being giggles."
Come on, Grace.
Yeah, this is serious literature.
You can't get it together.
Yeah, they'd throw you out of Cambridge for laughing at something like that. "Honored sir," this is how they talk in Cambridge, I thought.
It is.
"Honored sir, by this pinnace bean giggles." Oh. All right, yeah, I guess we gotta get serious now. You shall receive 48 or 50 women and children, unless there stay any here to be helpful, etc. Concerning which, there is one I formerly mentioned that is the fairest and largest that I saw amongst them, to whom I have given a coat to cloth her. It is my desire to have her for a servant, if it may stand with your good liking." So yeah, that's the type of transaction that Winthrop was involved in.
And very chill guy. Very normal. This is like the fifth fucking time he's come up.
Well, yeah, definitely. And he comes up sort of in Scarlet Letter, but all those guys do, right? And they come up in the context of deciding what to do with Hester and the child, right? Like this is the hands-onness of the patriarchy is very explicit and evident, in especially in the 1600s basically.
Well, there's something that we haven't necessarily, like, we've always like been near it, but maybe haven't talked about it a whole lot, that at this, at like the height of the Enlightenment, where they're like steeped in classical literature, that their takeaways, I feel like classical literature currently in 2018 has this like pretty high esteem, like the humanities as a way to like guide people off from tyranny and things like that. But Winthrop was well versed in Greek and Latin and had read all of Aristotle to find out how alchemy works. So it's a real nail in the coffin, or at least something to keep in mind when it's like these things may not be able to save you just on their own.
Right. All right, we'll play a little bit more here.
The governor redeemed her children and assured her that they should be cared for. For herself, misery and sorrow had so wrought on her that she was fast sinking into the grave. Oh, yeah. Many Christian men and women labored for her conversion, but she would not even consent that the Holy Word should be interpreted to her, insisting in the pride of her soul that all the children of the Great Spirit were equal objects of his favor, and that he had not deemed the book he had withheld needful to them. And did she, inquired Mrs. Fletcher, thus perish in her sins? She died, replied her husband, immovably fixed in those sentiments. But, Martha, we should not suit God's mercy to the narrow frame of our thoughts. This poor savage's life, as far as it comes to our knowledge, was marked with innocence and good deeds. I would gladly believe that we may hope for her, on that broad foundation laid by the Apostle Peter. In every nation, he that feareth God and worketh righteousness is accepted of him. That text, answered Mrs. Fletcher, her heart easily kindling with the flame of charity, is a light behind many a dark scripture, like the sun shining all around the edges of a cloth that would fain hide its beams. Such thoughts, my dear wife, naturally spring from thy kind heart, and are sweet morsels for private meditation, but it were well to keep them in thine own bosom, lest, taking breath, they should lighten the fears of unstable souls.
The mention of Mononoke, I don't have it in front of me here, but actually is tied to a real-life request made by the wife of a sachem. Pequot women appear to have been well acquainted. This is again from Kramer. Pequot women appear to have been well acquainted with the sexual violence that accompanied servitude within Anglo-American households. When news arrived that the wife of a Pequot sachem had been, quote, violently taken from the Dutch by Captain Underhill, the woman quickly made her captors aware that it had only been through her intervention that two English women abducted in the Pequot's raid on Wethersfield in April 1637 had been kept in safety and good health. The Pequot woman employed this political strategy to negotiate her status with her Anglo-American captors. John Winthrop reported that she was, quote, a woman of a very modest countenance and behavior, and that, quote, one of her first requests was that the English would not abuse her body and that her children might not be taken from her. These telling requests implied that female Pequot captives both expected sexual abuse and removal of their children. This woman was rewarded by being put directly under the care of the Bay Colony's governor himself. Most Pequot women, unfortunately, lack the political and social status that afforded such protection. And it is weird, like the can she go to heaven though? Like that, I understand. Like I empathize with why religious people would go to that. But that's not the pressing question about that, right? like, why are we enslaving these people and destroying them would probably be the more pertinent one.
Yeah, you'd go to physics first.
Are we going to heaven, maybe? Yeah. Are we going to heaven despite very clearly acting satanic the entire time we've been on this slab of earth? Right, let's just go a little bit further because there's a bit more about slavery I want to talk about here.
But here comes the girl, Megawiska, clothed in her Indian garb, which the governor has permitted her to retain, not caring, as he wisely says, to interfere with their innocent peculiarities, and she, in particular, having shown loathing of the English dress.
So it says there that Winthrop allowed her to keep her dress, her own dress on, and that actually is a super important factor here, and one that I found very interesting, especially in the context of cultural appropriation discussions, and how actually like, and that's not, you know, my general like bailiwick, but I do think when you have a historical understanding of the importance of who's wearing what and why, you begin to notice certain patterns regarding power and how it's been expressed in this country.
She says here, that text is a light behind many a dark scripture. Mm-hmm. And he's like, No, keep that to yourself.
Right.
Don't say that out loud at church or whatever. What is that about? Is that him? Is that like a more radical sentiment than he thinks would be?
Yeah, that seems sort of like a, is that like a Anne Hutchinson sort of antinomianism thing?
I think, yeah, it's supposed to be some sort of oblique reference to women interpreting scripture, which at that time was verboten, unlike now. She would have, like, this would have essentially been like happening at the same time as Anne Hutchinson, who was having Bible studies, and that was verboten and like disgusting. It was going to upend the social order. So her saying that, like, I have, you know, I've been illuminated with a reading from scripture. He's like, would you shut the fuck up? Like, you're going to get us all killed.
Yeah, keep it to yourself.
And is that dark scripture, is that a reference to like the sort of wrathful Old Testament vibe God compared to this more egalitarian notion, like anyone who fears God and is righteous can be accepted?
I thought I kind of read it from that, and then expounding on the theme further in the book, that she's able to get, like, characters are able to get like a moral understanding of the world through their own reason, which is suggested as like God-given in this book. But it's like, as her as a reader, the book itself, like, or scripture itself is wicked, but she can illuminate some transcendent qualities from it, basically, was my reading.
Yeah.
Here's a bit from Kramer on the clothing part. And we already talked about how that guy requesting the fairest and largest of the Pequot women gave her a coat. Kramer continues, "The captain emphasized the bodily characteristics of the captive Pequot woman whom he found desirable. In Stoughton's eyes, her body marked her as the fairest and largest, which led him to single her out for possession. This possession occurred by the act of covering the Pequot woman with his coat to cloth her. As a Pequot wrapped in Anglo-American textiles, she became one of his belongings. Clothing played an important role in the construction of gendered identities for 17th century Anglo-American men and women. Anne Little has offered a compelling analysis of the way that English soldiers were threatened by Pequot men who also dressed in Anglo-American clothes. That the loss of clothing was experienced as a loss of gender identity," writes Little, "is most apparent in descriptions of Indians stripping defeated Anglo-American soldiers. Bereft of their clothing, armor, and weapons, they were stripped of all proof of their manhood. Thus, the significance of covering a captured Pequot woman in an Anglo-American coat can be seen as a pivotal symbolic act of possession." So by showing Winthrop allowing this girl to maintain her own clothing, Sedgwick is sort of soft peddling a little bit about who this guy was. And I think it's important to note that, even though to just keep in mind what the cutting edge of humanitarian and liberalism at this time could show and what it couldn't.
But in the world of the novel, it's also really important that she gets to keep her clothes, because she's figured as this like essential, kind of essentialized version of a native young woman who is clothed in that particular way.
Right. And actually, just to go back to what Sedgwick was working off, her sources would have all been like Bradford and these guys, right? And they, as I discussed in the Mystic Massacre episode, not the most scrupulous in keeping a truthful historic record. And so, but I think Sedgwick actually, with the way that she, and we'll get to more of this with the in the later episodes when we talk about the massacre, I think she actually plays with the historiography of that in a way that actually has aged very well, and like a modern novelist would be considered savvy. We've talked a little bit about how this Sedgwick is sensitive to it enough, at least relative to other novelists, about how different gender and racial ideas are being cemented in the time that she's writing about. I'm going to go a little bit forward into just a tad bit forward in chapter 2, to where Magawiska is interacting with Jeanette and Mrs. Fletcher. Jeanette, will have to have a discussion about her. Yeah, here we go.
"Mr. Fletcher surveyed her for a moment with a mingled feeling of compassion and curiosity, and then turning away and leaning his head on the mantelpiece, his thoughts reverted to the subject that had affected him far more deeply than he had ventured to confess, even to the wife of his bosom. Mrs. Fletcher's first feeling was rather that of a housewife than a tender woman, My husband, she thought, might as well have brought a wild doe from the forest to plow his fields as to give me this Indian girl for household labor. But the wisest men have no sense in these matters. This natural domestic reflection was soon succeeded by a sentiment of compassion, which scarcely needed to be stimulated by Everil's whisper of, "Do, mother, speak to her." "Megawiska," she said in a friendly tone, "you are welcome among us, girl." Megawiska bowed her head. Mrs. Fletcher continued, "You should receive it as a signal mercy, child, that you have been taken from the midst of a savage people and set in a Christian family." Mrs. Fletcher paused for her auditor's assent, but the proposition was either unintelligible or unacceptable to Megawiska. "Mistress Fletcher means," said a middle-aged serving woman who had just entered the room, "that you should be mightily thankful, Tawny, that you are snatched as a brand from the burning." "Hush, Jeanette," said Everil Fletcher, touching the speaker with the point of an arrow which he held in his hand. Megawiska's eyes had turned on Jeanette, flashing like a sunbeam through an opening cloud. Everil's interposition touched a tender chord, and when she again cast them down, a tear trembled on their lids. "You will have no hard service to do," said Mrs. Fletcher, resuming her address. "I cannot explain all to you now, but you will soon perceive that our civilized life is far easier, far better, and happier than your wild wandering ways, which are indeed, as you will presently see, but little superior to those of the wolves and foxes." Megawiska suppressed a reply that her heart sent to her quivering lips, and Everil said, "Hunted as the Indians are, to their own dens, I'm sure, mother, they need the fierceness of the wolf and the cunning of the fox." "True, true, my son," replied Mrs. Fletcher, who really meant no unkindness in expressing what she deemed a self-evident truth. And then turning again to Megawiska, she said in a gentle tone, "You have had a long and fatiguing journey, was it not, girl?" "My foot," replied Megawiska, "is used to the wild wood path. The deer tires not of his way on the mountain, nor the bird of its flight in the air." She uttered her natural feeling in so plaintive a tone that it touched the heart like a strain of sad music, and when Jeanette again officiously interposed in the conversation by saying that, "Truly, these savages have their house in the wilderness, and their way no man knows," her mistress cut short her outpouring by directing her to go to the outer door and learn who it was who Digby was conducting to the house.
So yeah, Jeanette the domestic servant, white woman, domestic white servant, big old bigot against the Pequot girl. This is again from Kramer. "The emphasis on possession of the physical body and the captive's identity connoted utter subjugation to Anglo-American authority and the possessibility of physical and sexual violence." Quote, this is about Roger Williams. This is from Roger Williams. Quote, "Sir, there are two Pequot squaws brought by the Narragansett almost starved," reported Roger Williams to John Winthrop. "The biggest Mr. Coles, his native," this is a bit confusing because it's written in Roger Williams' old style, "the biggest Mr. Coles, his native, complains that she of all natives in Boston is used worst, is beaten with fire sticks, especially by some of the servants. This Pequot woman's experience revealed the racialized hierarchy that accompanied the practice of captivity in 17th century New England English settlements. Unwilling to accept Pequot servants as their equals, Anglo-American servants already working in English households resorted to physical abuse of their Indian counterparts." And I think that is basically what Jeanette is. That's her. She's the cipher for that, right? And she's very bigoted, so much so that the narrator completely turns on her throughout this novel. There's one point where, I'm not going to spoil anything for you. We're just going to save that. But let's just say that the narrator kind of...
Excellent tease. You're going to want to read it.
Yeah, the narrator just does not care about Jeanette. And in a way that I think, actually, you could use to critique, liberalism nowadays? Because I think, like, you talk about Trump and how that's projected as being the poor whites, right? Mm-hmm. That's not the case at all. It's the poor whites vote for Democrat over Republican. And it's curious to me because I actually think this is probably more true in Cedric's time than it is now, almost, like, because of that immediate hierarchy and precariousness of domestic servants, right? Like, they're going to feel the colonization of it. We've had a debate on Majority Report about whether or not you can say something like capitalism invented slavery, racism. And my sort of amendment to that is I think colonialism and a Marxist understanding of how labor is divided among people is key to understanding how people develop ideas about race. And that's what Cedric sort of mentions in the preface, right? Conditions lead to the character.
Well, I guess you would say that there was a form of exploitation before slavery and before capitalism. That capitalism, yes, may have formed the mass production of chattel slavery based on race, but the idea of a state power, governing power, I guess would be more accurate, exploiting people's labor for their own gains, predates both slavery and capitalism.
Yeah, and that's why I would... I actually think colonialism created racism is more at least tenable to me, at least chronologically speaking. Because actually, in Ibram Kendi's Stand from the Beginning, he talks about Aristotle having the concept of basically sun people and ice people, basically, right? And,
yeah,
and Ethiopians were given that name that apparently means black face, burnt face, as far as I understand. And there, you saw different semblances, but it really takes until capitalism and colonialism to really juice that into a global, you know, sort of a formal project.
Well, and I think that this book plays with that in a cunning way. The idea of, like, the book smart, learned person can't see the moral atrocity that's right in front of them, mm-hmm, especially with that long diatribe of, like, you don't understand, like, that this is actually good for you. Meanwhile, and because she thinks that Magawiska grew up in the wild and is therefore, like, doesn't even know what's in her own best interest.
Yeah.
But this book would suggest that the fact that Magawiska has a closer connection to nature, that she has a closer connection to a reasonable understanding of right and wrong, or like an inert understanding that has been closed off from Jeanette because she's had to buy into so many constructs, basically, that she doesn't even know that she's a slave, basically, anymore.
Right. Yeah.
But I hadn't considered, actually, until just now, that the fact that Sedgwick has so little empathy for Jeanette.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I totally joined in with mocking her and,
yeah,
kind of thinking that she was the biggest bigot of the book, and she kind of bears all of that weight, mm-hmm, in the novel, whereas the other more kind of quote-unquote civilized or more humanistically driven characters, we kind of empathize with them as readers.
Right.
I hadn't considered how cruel that actually is,
yeah,
to Jeanette.
It's super cruel, actually. And I think that's something that's going to be... And I totally agree, because, like, it's annoying. The racist is annoying, right? But when you make the racist the lower class person, that's problematic, because it wasn't the lower class people who were making these decisions that was,
right,
leading to
right,
like, literally this racism.
Well, yeah, and you can tie that back to what you were saying about, like, the average Trump voter is seen as like a son of
still
the soil
to this
or a
day
backwater hick, when
it's
your boss.
Yeah, it's
that's
your,
the one who
it's
is
your boss,
keeping you in power.
It's the guy who you bought your used car from. It's like, it's assholes.
It's
who,
Randy. I'll give you the address.
Yeah. Yeah. No. It's Tucker Carlson.
Oh my God.
How dare you go to his house?
Got nothing to say about that.
I'll be sleeping fine tonight. That's
I would
all
just
I would
say, if I was asked about things like that, I would give answers similar to the ones Magawiska gives to the family that he's enslaved in the next few chapters.
Just something like insufferable, being like, should Tucker Carlson be harassed? Like, I don't know, how far does the river run?
You leave some like a rattlesnake rattle on his porch. Decode that, you racist asshole. So yeah, fuck Tucker Carlson. Now, Let's we can actually move to wrapping up. We're going to wrap up epistolaric fashion.
I don't want to be imperialistic with my pronunciation though here.
No, it's fine. I mean,
everything to do with reading comprehension.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with what side of the pond we're on.
Well, I mean, yeah, now that if we're going to have Cambridge people listening to this, I better get my epistolary.
But yeah, my Brooklyn College bona fides have now been demolished.
This is at the end of chapter 3, just about, where Mrs. Fletcher is writing to her husband, who is in Boston with Hope on business, and Mrs. Fletcher is there with Hope's sister, who's newly looking after the daughter, her son with Fletcher, Everil Fletcher, Megawiska and Megawiska's brother Oniko, and a little baby. And she's there alone, looking over the house. Also, Digby and Jeanette, the servants, are there as well. And Digby is a veteran of the Pequot War, which will come up in the later episodes. But he's there basically as the man of the house to like shoot at you people, and you know, protect it. But this is where Mrs. Fletcher is writing to her husband, and sort of giving an update of how the servants are doing. and also there's some vague forebodings.
I am grieved to tell you that some misrule hath crept in among thy servants in thy absence. Alas, what are sheep without their shepherd? Digby is, as ever, faithful, not serving with eye service. But Hutton hath consorted much with some evildoers who have been violating the law of God and the law of our land by meeting together in merry companies, playing cards, dancing, and the like. Man. For these offenses, they were brought before Mr. Pynchon, and he sentenced to receive each 20 stripes well laid on.
Now, that Pynchon is related to Thomas Pynchon, the... he goes all the way back. And also Pynchon, I don't know if Pynchon comes up in, I don't think he comes up in Scarlet Letter.
There's another one that we read that the name's there, but I can't remember which one it is.
Well, I know he's, there's a Pynchon family in the House of Seven Gables.
I think it's in, oh, this is not interesting now, but it's the one where he goes for his night stroll.
Goodman Brown. I think you might be right, yeah.
In the forest.
Oh, have you read this one?
I listened to your episode.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, then you heard the every single minute of it.
All right, here we go. Yeah, exactly.
Hutton, furthermore, having been overtaken with drink, was condemned to wear suspended around his neck for 1 month a bit of wood on which Toper is legibly written.
I don't know what that means.
Who was ever a dawdler, having gone last Saturday
drunk, maybe,
with the cart to the village, dilly-dallied about there and did not set out on his return till the sun was quite down, both to the eye and by the calendar. Accordingly, early on the following Monday, he was summoned before Mr. Pynchon and ordered to receive 10 stripes, but by reason of his youth and my intercession, which, being by a private letter, doubtless had some effect, the punishment was remitted, whereby he heartily promised amendment and a better carriage. There hath been some alarm here within the past few...
Yeah, I just want to just dwell on the servant update. That's a fun genre of writing to do.
This is what they've been doing since you've been gone.
Dancing, playing.
They're playing cards.
God, can you imagine playing cards?
This reminds me of your fun fact about how a rocking chair was entertainment.
Oh, yeah.
In the 19th century. Like, they're on the rocking chair nonstop.
I wanted to have a section of like entertainment reviews from centuries ago.
It was
like,
cup and ball.
I traveled 15 miles for Mr. Pynchon's rocking chair, and I must say I was on there for 3 hours in the afternoon, and it
Mayor took a rest.
It wasn't a jot less enjoyable after the 80th rocking than after the first. That's entertainment. That was Entertainment Weekly. New rocking chair technology. Yeah, and then, yeah, exactly. We won't want to get into the other things that were sport back then. Yeah, and here's where we get the sense of vague forebodings, as I like. I think I got that from the book, but I don't know. It's a fun couple of words. Like a foreboding is probably vague enough. You rarely get
a little redundant, but it has its little poetic charm.
Yeah. Vague forebodings. It sounds like some sort of incense or no, cologne or something.
Oh
like
yeah.
There hath been some alarm here within the past few days on account of certain Indians who have been seen lurking in the woods around us. They are reported not to have a friendly appearance. We have been advised to remove for the present to the fort. But as I feel no apprehension, I shall not disarrange my family by taking a step that would savor more of fear than prudence. I say I feel no apprehension, yet I must confess it, I have a cowardly womanish spirit, and fear is set in motion by the very mention of danger. There are vague forebodings hanging about me, and I cannot drive them away even by the thought that your presence, my honored husband, will soon relieve me from all agitating apprehensions and repair all the faults of my poor judgment.
Daddy.
Fearful thoughts press on me. Untoward accidents have prolonged thy absence. Our reunion may yet be far distant, and if it should never chance in this world, oh, remember that I have fallen far short in duty. The measure of my love hath been full. I have ever known that mine was Leah's portion, that I was not the chosen and the loved one, and this has sometimes made me fearful, often joyless. But remember, it is only the perfect love of the husband that casteth out the fear of the wife.
Damn.
That's a good point.
Yeah, nothing to quibble with there.
Yeah.
The end.
There's so much pathos in her that I almost... Especially like in tonight, I felt this. And maybe I've had hints of this before reading it, but it's almost like, you know, you there's a game that's probably not the most fruitful to play with novels. But which character does the writer identify with the most? And this wouldn't be Sedgwick, because Sedgwick is actually unmarried. I think part of her unmarriedness is also understanding the pathos of unhappy marriages, and she writes about, and I think some of her non-fictional work is about that sort of thing. I need to go a bit more in research in that, but I think she's, I mean, actually I'm just going to look at her non-fiction stuff. If you guys have anything to say,
do you know that so she was unmarried, was that by choice?
Yes.
Oh yeah,
generally I think, yeah,
so she avoided it.
Well, on that note, I thought it was really fascinating that the final paragraph of the novel, and I can talk about this without spoilers, mm-hmm. because it kind of zooms out at the end, is not, as you might expect, about these kind of grand themes of identity and race and ethnicity that she's been dealing with, but she kind of has like a dig at marriage in the final mm-hmm. paragraph of the book. She says, talking about Esther Downing, who's this model Puritan woman who is sort of proffered as a possible bride for Everall, but ends up going back to England. She says that her fate, which was not to marry, was a lesson that marriage is not essential to the contentment, the dignity, or the happiness of woman.
Mm.
Which is a kind of crazy note to end the book on.
Yeah, and she would actually return to this, because I'm reminded by this, that she wrote a book, and I'm trying to figure out if this isn't... Married or Single was her final book published.
One page long. Sounds single. Great. The end.
It was just her like Facebook relationship status. She just had to publish
it. This is going to be way funnier in 200 years.
Married or Single, published in 1857, was Catherine Maria Sedgwick's final novel. Oh, I didn't even know that was a novel. I thought it was one of her nonfiction works. Hmm. Final novel and a fitting climax to the career of one of antebellum America's first and most successful women writers. Insisting on women's rights to choose whether to marry, Married or Single rejects the stigma of spinsterhood and offers readers a wider range of options for women in society, recognizing their need and ability to determine the course of their lives. So that might need to be put on the syllabus for this book, because, yeah.
Well, it definitely draws into relief her. She references Milton quite a few times, mm-hmm. and, you know, his, like, obsession before he wrote Paradise Lost was... marriage and no-fault divorce, because he hated his wife so much. like no one should ever be married to this fucking annoying woman. So I wonder if... Because, I mean, that's literally the, like, his second major output besides that epic poem is about divorce. And not just divorce, and being able to, like, be on your own, and you don't necessarily have to be married and things like that. And I wonder if... she sees like some simpatico with him because he's littered throughout Hope Leslie.
Mm. Well, the one Milton reference I can remember off the top of my head is mentioning how the houses were built in the Miltonic, the style of Milton's Birth.
Yeah.
Which to me, that's just interesting in the sense that that's a reference that she would make, right? Like she's like, which paintings are in currency, among, you know, intelligentsia types. I think we've done a pretty good job on this, first edition here. Thank Grace and Alex for, joining me tonight.
Yeah, we did it.
And we really did it.
It's fun.
For those of you listening on the public feed, you'll probably have noticed that I uploaded the chapters pertaining to this episode for you to listen to for free. I'm going to be uploading the rest of those as well, eventually, once I finish them all. But if you want to support the show and get access to all of the all of my readings as I upload them initially, patreon.com/literaryhangover. Check that out. We're also on YouTube. That will do it for this episode of Literary Hangover.